Vance Rogers Brown was appointed to the Court of Appeals, U.S. Court of Appeals in 2005. She graduated from UCLA Law School. She also received a Master's of Law from UVA Law School. She served as the Deputy in the Office of Legislative Counsel for the State of California, as Deputy Attorney General in the California Attorney General's Office, and as Deputy Secretary of General Counsel for California's Business, Transportation, and Housing Agency. She then entered private practice as a senior associate of a Sacramento firm. In 1991, Judge Brown earned, through the government service, the Legal Affairs Secretary to the California Governor Pete Wilson. From 1994 to 1996, she served as an Associate Justice of the California Court of Appeal, and then from 1996 to 2005, as an Associate Justice of the California Supreme Court. Those are the dry biographical details. But Judge Brown is far more than that. She's come to her own ideas, and they're very well thought out ideas through reading and thinking. Many of us would like to think we've done the same, but frankly, most of us have lots of guidance and not really educated ourselves without a fair number of mentors. And I think, at least in your intellectual development and philosophically, as I said, she really did this on her own. I remember a few years back, I kept on hearing from our West Coast Federalists, we have this really bright and capable justice in the California Supreme Court. She's writing these very well-known opinions. You really ought to get her involved in speaking if she is willing. And after some years, we're doing something like that. Seriously, she has had the honor of speaking to a number of federal society events over the last few years, one of which landed her in some controversy during her hearings, as I recall. She delivered a very interesting speech to her Chicago chapter. Some sort of thought her senators violated the litmus test for what judges should be allowed to believe. And one of the striking things about her talks is they are always thoughtful and they don't always conform to what it is okay to say or even what many of her people who agree with her generally philosophically think maybe she should say. It can be quite striking. I'll just give one quote and then bring it up here. She said, a court of last resort is supposed to do more than resolve individual differences. Such courts ought to be building for the future, providing guidance, structure, stability, instilling confidence in the primacy of the rule of law. But alas, the decisions of such courts, including my own, when she was on the California Supreme Court, seem ever more ad hoc and expedient, perilously adrift on the rolling seas, a feckless photo op compassion and political correctness. And we are, by and large, captives in an intellectual world that is completely antithetical to the kinds of substantial limits an authentic historical interpretation of our Constitution would impose. We are committed to doing the right thing, but with only our feelings to guide us, most of the time we cannot figure out what the right thing is. I actually think maybe some senators read, if not that, a couple of other quotes, and that may have contributed to some of the long discussions we had. In any case, I just want to say, for example, her intellectual interest and openness, her commitment to the honest pursuit of ideas, and her commitment to law make her the perfect speaker tonight. And I'm truly honored to introduce you to the Honorable Judge Janice Rogers.
Thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here for the 27th Annual Student Symposium of the Federalists. I want to thank Craig Chokiewicz for offering the invitation. And I also want to thank someone who helped me out of what would have been a mortifying predicament this afternoon. I am like Tennessee Williams, flawed heroine, often dependent on the kindness of strangers. and today, I really was, and you should thank this person too, because but for her, I'd be standing here before you in this suit, wearing knee highs, and it wouldn't be a pretty picture. And one other housekeeping detail, I've been told by the Duke contingent that if I am not finished by 9, they will be leaving. So I just want to say they are forgiven, and I will join you for the second half. I came to my topic. One of the things that Jean said tonight is something that perhaps hasn't been revealed before, which is that the things I talk about are things for which no one can be blamed except me. This is true. And usually when I speak, I just talk about the things that are of interest to me at the moment. So you get a lot of what I'm thinking. And so this speech developed when I was at a recent conference in Arizona. And I was touched by a very moving musical tribute to the ideals on which our nation was founded. And this anthem was written by Jason Varney and performed by Jordan Reed, and it's entitled The Fortress Stone. The anthem is striking not only for its beautiful lyrical depiction of our founding's first principles, but also for the challenge that it poses to modern-day Americans, and I think particularly to young Americans. And here's a little bit of the prologue to this anthem, which is part of a program that's done in Gilbert, Arizona. And why Gilbert, Arizona should decide to celebrate the Constitution with a huge, full-fledged, day-long program, I don't know. But I'm delighted with the people of Gilbert, Arizona. Anyway, the prologue starts this way, and I'll return later to the lyrics. That since the dawn of time, tyrants have conspired to rob humanity of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But the Constitution has stood for over two centuries as a protective fortress, sheltering generation after generation from those who would destroy freedom. Consider our role in defending the very fortress that defends us all. Consider both its immense power, but also its fragile vulnerability. This wall of protection is only as strong as our devotion to know, to live, and to safeguard its truth. And when I heard that, it reminded me of something else that I read a long time ago that always stuck in my mind, which I think is also true, which is Vernon Hand's speech that he gave all the way back in 1945 called The Spirit of Liberty. And in that speech he said, liberty lies in the hearts of men and women. When it dies there, no constitution, no law, no court can save it. No constitution, no law, no court can even do much to help. And so I think this prologue captures that in another way. This language echoes the recurrent vision of America as a shining city on a hill, a place of refuge and expectation and special destiny. But I think these words sank so deeply into my heart because recent events have caused me to think a lot about the vulnerability of a regime like ours. The Constitution has sheltered us from those who would destroy freedom. But the fortress is incredibly threatening because it is only as strong as our devotion and allegiance. Our Constitution both reflects and embodies American exceptionalism. And you will have a choice, and each generation of Americans has had a choice, to decide whether America's exceptional ideals deserve your allegiance. For your generation, it is a unique and challenging choice, because American exceptionalism is now sometimes seen as more of an embarrassment than a blessing. American exceptionalism has not always caused such discomfiture. We've always had a high opinion of ourselves, and some might say undeservedly so. But until quite recently, Americans also had a shared sense of destiny. A brief reference to our nation's favorite superhero illustrates the point. If I asked an audience of people my age, what does Superman fight for? The answer would come back immediately: truth, justice, and the American way. But when I ask an audience your age, that question usually elicits wrinkled brows and blank stares. Unless you're an addict of Mega Knight. Okay? Even worse, in the latest Superman movie, our beloved superhero shies away from American exceptionalism by declaring that he now fights for truth, justice, and all that stuff. And the movie's writers acknowledge the change was deliberate. Superman, they say, is now an international hero, and they did not expect international audiences to understand the American way. And how could they, when the American writers admit they rejected the term American way because they were uncertain what it meant? Even so, I suspect most Americans still think America is unique. Americans are exceptional people, and that America has a special role to play in human destiny. We just don't know what the heck it is anymore. Once we possess that American cool and certitude, God had blessed America, we thought, because it was good. These days, we are not so sure. Legal scholars now seriously argue we, out of, quote, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, ought to reinvent ourselves. The Supreme Court liberally sprinkled its opinions with citations to foreign law and foreign public opinion. And the loyal opposition that once characterized American politics has been reduced to an echo chamber of old Europe's virulent anti-Americanism. Why the identity crisis? And why now? Our uniqueness has always been apparent. According to Samuel Huntington's article in Foreign Affairs, American identity historically has had two primary components, culture and creed. Our culture derives from Western civilization, including the values and institutions of the original settlers, who were Northern European Christians, primarily of the Protestant British variety. Our creed is a set of universal principles articulated in our founding document: liberty, equality, democracy, constitutionalism, limited government, and private property. On these principles, there was once wide agreement. Insightful foreign observers such as Tocqueville hailed our creed as, in Huntington's words, the cement and the structure of this great and disparate nation. All this led Richard Hofstadter to note it has been our fate as a nation not to have ideologies, but to be one. America's founding was one of a kind, perhaps miraculous, at least providential. At a particular moment in political history, human beings arrived at a conception of the universe and man's place in it that could support a regime of human freedom. President Reagan's farewell address, which evoked the shining city, built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds, living in harmony and peace, still brings a lump to my throat. But powerful as that image is, even our glimpse of that shining city only lasts for a moment before the forces of moral entropy began to pour the thunder. Nevertheless, our ancestors did see it, we inherited it, and we still feel its spell. Just the afterglow of that luminous vision was enough to raise the expectations of the whole world. Now the world seeks to return the favor, or do they? There is real concern that America no longer enjoys the respect of other nations, that she will find herself alone in this flat world unless she submits to global consensus. After all, continental drift has never been just a geological phenomenon. It has always been more of an ideological one. Many of our ideas about freedom of speech and press, religious freedom, capital punishment, and property rights have been resoundingly rejected by other liberal democracies. So the question is whether America is really different from other liberal democracies, more libertarian, patriotic, optimistic, individualistic, and moralistic than Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Israel, or even Japan, then I think the answer is yes. But why is that? And is it a good or bad thing? Does it show America needs to take a clue from the rest of the world in light views? Or does it show we have charted a different and better course? If it's the latter option, then it's vitally important for us to understand that course and to decide whether it's worth fighting for. The historian Jacques Barzon divides the last 500 years into three eras. He says the years 1500 to 1560 were dominated by the issue of man's relation to God. 1661 through 1789 by the age of individual status and the mode of government. 1790 to 1920, and I would say thereafter, by the question of how to achieve social and economic equality. The American Revolution falls into the second category. The French Revolution is in the third. That is, the American Revolution represented the culmination of religious consciousness applied to the design of government, while the French Revolution heralded the beginning of the secular age. And the discontinuity in worldview has made all the difference. America's founders were not utopian idealists. They knew Western consciousness included two ways of understanding the world. Either man is created and fallen, or man is an accidental product of nature. If it's the former, then human nature is flawed, and in a way that humans cannot remedy, because it's fixed. If it's the latter, then humanity is evolving and can be made and remade until perfection is achieved. Thus, America's founders acknowledged the practical limits of human reason and relied on the lamp of experience. In contrast, the French Revolution succumbed to the powerful notion of abstract human life and insisted on reinventing the world with principles that were utterly divorced from the reality of human nature. According to the French revolutionaries, man can remake his history and himself generation by generation through some collective cultural process. In America, where our founders were fully cognizant of man's selfish nature, we think we can see the difference between political freedom and political slavery. And in a much earlier epoch, perhaps we could. But in a modern world where slavery is simply packaged as a sensible, compassionate alternative to the status quo, the divide between freedom and slavery is often obfuscated. Alas, the regime effect of modern liberalism prompts us to seek political slavery. T.S. Eliot provides one of the most cogent descriptions of this dynamic. He says, by destroying traditional social habits of the people, by dissolving their natural collective consciousness, by licensing the opinions of the most foolish, by substituting instruction for education, by encouraging cleverness rather than wisdom, the upstart rather than the qualified, by fostering a notion of getting on to which the only alternative is halfway apathy, liberalism can prepare the way for that which is its own negation, the artificial, mechanized, or brutalized control, which is a desperate remedy for its chaos. In this worldview, America's failures serve as justifications for jettisoning everything. There is no understanding of how the fires we have faced as a nation have refined and clarified our creed. Nor is there any patience for sober expectation. Basic decency and imperfect justice aren't good enough. This seems a curious position for a political movement that has spent the last 200 years seeking to reshape society through industrial development, social engineering, and various forms of wealth redistribution, a process that was supposed to bring forth a new man, a new and improved humanity, a process that has repeatedly failed with miserable and catastrophic consequences. After all, the French field sauce set out to end absolutism, but they established a dictatorship that made the ancient regime look liberal. The Marxists said they would end the exploitation of men, but proceeded to exploit men more ferociously than ever. The 1960s radicals railed against imperialist oppression and advocated the flowering of personal freedom, but they attacked democracy and praised bloody Maoist totalitarianism. Unfortunately, liberal education has paved much of the way toward the hapless apathy Eliot described. Well, the teaching of American history and values isn't being distorted by selective omission. It's suffering from inexcusable neglect. Civics is rarely taught in high school anymore, and recent studies report that college seniors know almost nothing about American history, government, or market economics. Earning an F on the American Civic Literacy exam with a score of 54. At premier universities do a worse job. Seniors at Ivy League institutions actually show less civic competence than freshmen. We Americans love our Constitution, but we know little about what is in it and less about the principles it attempts to sustain. As Professor Sabato of the University of Virginia has noted, many Americans believe the president may suspend the Constitution in time of war, that the Constitution establishes English as our official language, and, this is my personal favorite, that Marx's maxim, from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, is included in the Constitution. Given this depressing background, consider Bardon's wry observation. When the nation's history is poorly taught in schools, ignored by the young, and proudly rejected by qualified elders, awareness of tradition consists only in wanting to destroy it. The world is increasingly without rational political order. The hope of human freedom faces relentless and possibly lethal assault. The latest charge portrayed as America's stubborn refusal to embrace the benevolent and sagacious international collective picks up where the New Deal of the Great Society left off. Human perfectibility, a notion the framers roundly rejected, is no longer a domestic political experiment. Liberalism has taken it to the next level, global level. There it has found a better incubator. Institutions easily captured by political elites and processes largely unknown and under scrutinized. Onto the post-World War II institutions designed for global security, liberalism has engrafted a network of multilateral treaties, resolutions, declarations, and the courts to interpret them. Animating this global framework is an idea masquerading as one of our own, universal human dignity, supposedly plucked from our Declaration of Independence, but shamelessly shorn from its Christian roots. Is both the international structure's foundation and goal, and it is achievable this time, so the engineers say, if only America's political institutions would govern according to global consensus, if only her Supreme Court would interpret her Constitution according to the opinion of international elites, if only Americans would elevate coercive egalitarianism over human freedom, if only Americans were not so religious. In other words, if only America wasn't America. If we knew who and what we are, these would not be choices, but repudiations of American constitutionalism. Their misguided premise, the framers thoroughly considered and discarded. But again, we are asked to make the choice, this time shaken and less confident. Our crisis of confidence is hardly surprising. As President Reagan said, if we forget what we did, we won't know who we are. And we are forgetting. Younger parents are sure that an unambivalent appreciation of America is the right thing to teach modern children. I'm an old movie buff, and just recently I came across an odd little picture that was channel surfing. And I came across this picture by a young woman from the Midwest who went to the local college and later became a teacher there. And I did some research and I found that this is probably a fictionalized version of the founding of the University of Nebraska. Anyway, this movie is called Tears for Mrs. Bishop. It is not great cinematic art, but I was fascinated by the dialogue. In the 1880s, when Miss Bishop is just beginning her college career, she hears the school's president speak to the university's inaugural class. And he says, quote, wisdom is the first cousin of freedom, and freedom is the glory of our nation and our people. Later, when Miss Bishop wants to quit teaching, the same president, Cochran, tells her, quote, we've got something here in this country, the idea of people being free. but it has to be taught and retaught to each new crop of youngsters, the value of freedom. This movie was released at the beginning of 1941, and the New York Times, already morose about the inevitability of America's entry into World War II, criticized the movie's sentimental nostalgia as unexciting and laboriously cute, meant to distract audiences from the bitter times ahead. And that may be, but the movie review completely misses the point. In many other nations, educators wouldn't speak as Cochran does. And most importantly, Cochran was right. Freedom has to be taught and retaught. We must teach history based not on what we fashion, but what's important. Near the movie's end, Miss Bishop is honored at a banquet acknowledging her retirement. She offers a toast. She says, "Here's to our nation. She's young, she's growing too fast, and she makes a lot of mistakes. But somehow, she does manage to keep her people free. May she always." The focus on remembering who we are brings us back to where we started. Our founders' exceptional values and their exceptional efforts to design government so it would maximize freedom and account for humanity's imperfection. Who could know that something as basic as one's view on human nature and the source of man's redemption would create such a deep and enduring rift in the political realm? Yet it does. Because of this difference in worldview, we designed our government differently than other nations. In America, we designed government to be small so faith could flourish and God's glory could fill the world. That might make the secular libertarians among you squirm, but that is an accurate description of how our ideas about liberty developed. In contrast, Europeans designed government to be all-encompassing, so men could be gods. They followed Machiavelli, and we rejected him. We made being an American an ideological commitment to universal and self-evident truth. As Lipset says, one may become an American by accepting the creed, but the meaning of being English, French, or German is predominantly a birthright status. And while they had state-established religion and became rabidly anti-religious, we opposed church establishment but welcomed religion and allowed it to flourish. These differences, though in plain sight, are difficult for us to discern now. This is so because important words have lost their meaning. John Adams says abusive words have been the great instrument of sophistry and chicanery, of party faction and division in society. America owns the oldest written constitution, but the world is now filled with them. And they often take their cues from international codification of sweeping social entitlement. So what divides us now is not our commitment to constitutionalism. It is our sharp disagreements about how to defend that constitution and secure its promise of liberty under law. Tyranny did not announce itself with trumpets. It may, as Marianne Linda tells us, come softly, so softly that we will barely notice. Or it may announce itself in the smoke from the distant fires of New York's once proud towers, when we are too diffident to do much more than wince. How we answer the question of human freedom is about more than American constitutionalism or American exceptionalism. We have to deal with what ails us as well as what confronts us. In some ways, they are the same. Challenges to freedom fueled by deadly petulance from all sides. If we now face an implacable enemy, that is nothing new. The totalitarian impulse has an endless array of new guises, new slogans, and new grievances. This is a war without end, and so it has always been. You will have to decide what to do, and history and posterity will pass judgment on your choices. Everything happens for a reason. Even rabid anti-Americanism from without and subtle erosion of American ideals from within. But whether these circumstances will serve as a launching pad for Western civilization's upward trajectory or a mile marker on the way to annihilation, we cannot know. With these challenges in mind, I want to return to the lyrics of The Fortress Stone. The song says, "When time has passed and we are gone, will freedom's fortress still be strong. would we become oppression's hand, if stone by stone we fail to stand? That is your choice, your challenge. Your courage, allegiance, and resolve make America what it is, the fortress that safeguards freedom and supports the shining city on a hill. In that Reagan farewell speech, the president spoke of a city on a granite ridge, her glow steady no matter what storm. I think he believed America's beacon would and should shed an exceptional light. We cannot know everything, but our experience allows us to see some things clearly, such as the fact that the obsession with perfection and power is always a calamity in politics. America can only be defended by people of courage and tenderness, resilience, and resolve. As John Adams confessed in the heat of the Revolutionary War, we cannot fully fathom God's providence. The events of war are uncertain. We can't guarantee success in this war. But we can do something better. We can deserve it. This is your choice and your challenge. You must decide whether America continues its commitment to individual freedom or surrenders to the collective politics of the hive. Whether the city on a hill remains a beacon. Whether the fortress stands or becomes only an interesting ruin for tourists of the future. Thank you.